I just want to ask, is it possible to walk on all paths to, you know, together?
It's an interesting question, and there are two answers to that. One is that all paths, of course, as the cliche goes, reach the same destination. But what one needs to understand is, for example, you see, we have given labels to these paths, bhakti and jnana yoga. Let's take these two examples. Now, the difference is in bhakti, for example, there's me and my relationship with God. In jnana yoga, that has changed to the me and God has changed to I am God. Or rather, God is me, you, he, and she. So when you see God in everyone, when you accept that everyone is an instrument through whom God functions, through whom consciousness functions, isn't that the ultimate bhakti? To me, that is the ultimate bhakti. So therefore, these paths are just labels given. Now, it may happen that you are inclined to one particular path or two paths. Your inclination may be, if you are on the bhakti mark, to have this worship of, let's say, Lord Krishna. And that becomes the bhakti mark for you. At the same time, you may be drawn to the teachings of Jnana Yoga. You see? So there is no conflict there, because that is the beauty and wonder of all the spiritual paths which are laid down before us. But if there is confusion that which is the path for me, then that is a problem to be looked into. Because what happens is the mind tends to create that confusion, but the heart knows which is the path I must follow. So the mind tends to try and do too many things without realizing that all paths lead to the same destination. And that is why Maharaj said that one finds water by not digging small wells all over the land, but by digging one deep well. So if in your heart you know that a particular path is the one you resonate with the most, then one should follow that.
So I have had the privilege of having Shirdi Sai Baba in my life 5 years back, and he's been with me ever since. And I have been initiated in Kevara 6 months ago, and I read upon the spiritual literature a lot, and it helps immensely. And I do meditate. I'm like, it's like grace is upon me from all quarters, basically. So and there's no confusion also, honestly. It's like I'm just surrounded with every possible thing that can help me go reach there, you know. And I've been inclined to Advaita a lot, and I've been finding people like you who can help, and it's coming from everywhere, wherever I have looked. So should I be like the thing is, I'm happy in all the spheres, basically.
So then you are in a beautiful space.
I am, but I just wanted to check with you, because is it possible to, you know, I am actually happy.
It is very possible. It is very possible. And if you are enjoying the journey, that is what counts. But I might add here that one must be clear about what one is looking for. Whether one knows it or not, the answer is peace of mind. Now, if you have that peace of mind, then by all means, explore whatever comes your way. And as you say, you're enjoying it and grace is upon you. But if that peace of mind is not there and one is not established in that, then you have to look at all that surrounds you and pick that one thing which made you feel most at peace. Because that is what will lead you to the destination. So supposing you met or you've heard 3-4 spiritual masters on this journey, or you have this Kriya Yoga path, Bhakti Yoga, ask yourself this question. Are you at peace? And if the answer is yes, it's fine. But if the answer is perhaps no, I'm not at peace, and that is why I'm listening to all these talks and coming across all these things, then pick that one and dig the well deep there. Because when Ramana Maharshi was asked that what is the criteria for my life and living, he replied, by the degree of peace that you feel. You see, now, as you mentioned, Shirdi Sai Baba, he himself has said to his devotees, when someone asked him, is a guru necessary? He has replied saying, a guru is necessary. You see, so that the guru shows you the way to that peace. So this is a question I would say is best answered when you ask this to yourself.
I'm so much at peace that I can't even put it in words, honestly. I'm so much at peace.
So then it's beautiful. And
the witnessing happens so naturally, it has become a default mechanism now with me. It is in every aspect of my waking moments.
That is wonderful.
I'm blessed, truly. I'm totally blessed. It's been a very beautiful journey. And I recently asked Baba, like 3-4 days back, I was asking Baba, would it ever happen that Gautam ji can come to Delhi? I can, you know, listen to him. And the very next day, I see that you're available here. So he just puts everything in my lap. Just, I ask for it and he just gives me.
You know, my teacher Ramesh ji would call someone like you Allah ke pyare.
I am really blessed, truly. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you directly, and thank you, seriously, a lot.
Yeah.
I have taken a lot of time. I would rather have others speak to you now. Thank you.
Gautam ji, this is Uttra here. How are you?
Who's that?
Uttara.
Uttara.
Yes, Uttara. So you can hear me clearly?
I can hear you, but I can't see you.
You don't want to see me. It's okay. Gautam ji, I have a very, I have an interesting question, according to me anyway.
I should also put my camera off, so then both formless voices talk to each other.
At the end, it is always formless, isn't it?
Yeah, tell me.
Okay, the question I have for you, Gautam ji, is you said in meditation, you got to witness your thoughts. Is it possible for the witness to feel the thoughts? Like, because when you said examples, when we look at our childhood memories, sometimes we don't remember the memory, but we remember the feeling with that certain memory. So we get that feeling. Who's that is feeling? And can the witness also feel the thought when the thought arises?
Yes, absolutely. But the witness does not get involved in that feeling. You see, what happens is let's say the memory comes of something wonderful which happened when you were a child. When you're sitting in meditation, the memory arises that I got this beautiful gift as a child and I was so happy. That is still the witnessing. But when this changes into I wish this happened again to me, it would be so nice. That is the involvement. So a feeling can certainly be witnessed. Feelings of pleasure can be witnessed. What happens is that the me then steps in and said, it is my pleasure and therefore I want more of it. That is what creates the suffering. And then the witnessing has turned into observing and judging as something that was good for me.
Thank you, Gautamji. Explains a bit.
Like I mentioned about fear. Fear may arise. But yes. That is just witnessed as a movement.
But sometimes you feel the fear, like your heart palpitates. Even in meditation, when you feel the fear, your physical body reacts to that fear. Your heart palpitates, you sweat a little bit. I don't know how you could control that, your physical reaction to that emotion of fear.
No, there's
even
no question.
Being a witness.
There is no question of controlling it if you are witnessing it. But I would like to add here, since you've used this example that your heart palpitates. See, the fear itself is a movement from the lowest chakra to the heart, because the survival issues are based in the Muladhara chakra. So you can actually feel, if the witnessing is total, you can feel the movement come up and then your heart starts pounding, right? Now, if there was pure witnessing, and I'm stating this because it happened in my case, where in one instance, I could actually feel the fear as a sensation arise from the base and come to the heart. And there was pure witnessing, and then that completely dropped from the heart. The fear just dropped from the heart. That was also witnessed, the movement of energy, of fear, and its dissolution. But when one is involved in that fear, and then that heart keeps pumping, because now a story is created. I am fearful, this is going to happen to me, that is going to happen to me. The witnessing is finished. Because the thinking mind has stepped in and taken full control of that fear as something happening to me. So if in meditation it arose, it can still be witnessing. But the involvement in the fear means the witnessing has turned into observing, which is now judging the fear.
How does one become... go from observing to a witness? So you have realized that you're now observing and you're involved in that fear. How do you then detach from that being an observant and then go back to being a witness? Because sometimes you just get involved and then you have to become a witness again, kind of have to separate yourself.
That realization itself is the witnessing. You cannot do anything to be a witness. The ego cannot do anything to witness. It is the absence of the doing which is the witness. So the realization that you were involved is the witnessing.
Got it. Thank you.
Hi, Gautam.
Hello.
You can hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, so my question is there anything beyond witnessing?
What is your name?
Meenakshi.
Meenakshi. Supposing you were standing at your window and you saw the cars going by. You are witnessing the cars going by, right?
Yeah.
Now, supposing no cars are going by, what would happen? There would be non-witnessing.
Right.
Now, supposing a sage is sitting in his chair, having a cup of coffee, and thoughts come up every now and then. Witnessing happens. Now, supposing no thoughts come up for the next 5 minutes, what happens is that the sage goes into non-witnessing. You see, what we tend to do, because our mind is perpetually punctuated with thoughts and thinking. When the sage's thinking mind is finished, the gap between two thoughts is longer than for us ordinary people. And in that gap, the sage slips into the non-witnessing state. And when that gap gets longer and longer, what happens could be termed as samadhi. Because when there is no thought, there is no thinker of the thought. And that is why sages where there is no thought arising would slip into samadhi. But for us, what we notice more and more is when witnessing is happening more and more, even non-witnessing is happening more and more. Because there's no compulsion for the ego to come in through the back door and get involved in other thoughts. So in that sense, what is beyond witnessing is non-witnessing, but they are not two. They are not two. When something is to be witnessed, it happens. And when nothing is happening, there is no witnessing, and then again the witness comes, because that is what daily living is about. But there is, in that process, there is no involvement as a me which judges what is observed.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Okay, Gautam, I have this question. So this is one situation, right? Recently happened. I'm from Denver, by the way. I'm Vikas. I have been following Ramana Maharshi's teachings and Maharaj teachings a lot. I have been in consulting, so I meet a lot of people, and there is a lot of worlds I meet, basically. And those amazing people teach me a lot of things. So beautiful things. Now, recently, you know, I came in one situation, basically one of my friend, he had a stroke and he is paralyzed left side. And now, you know, I said I will be helping him and, you know, his wife and, you know, to do all that massage and stuff and all those things. So for first 3 weeks, I did go. And now the question started coming, man, you know, this is like, I have my family also here and, you know, nobody goes out now. You know, there is this virus fear and all. And I was basically waiting, who can answer me this? Because I don't want to stop going, because, well, then why you are even following Maharaj's teachings, okay? Because, you know, Maharaj said in one of his, in his book that, yeah, there is, you know, problem in a world. And, you know, if there is a shooting going on here, and if I go and try to save someone, I may even get killed, right? So now I was still delaying it, you know, should I go, should I not go? And because definitely I don't want to bring that at home where I have my kids and, you know, my family. But I was not ready to say no. But finally, there is so much of panic everywhere. Finally, I had to take call based on my previous experience where, you know, I met one guy in Florida, you know, he had his own challenges and that's okay. So I would try to keep distance from him and, you know, I would not go with hang out with him, even though I was staying in with him. So my prarabdha was just sit inside that room and listen to Ramana Maharshi, right? So now there also I chose a discrimination power that I did not accept the other, he, you know, going and hanging out with him as my prarabdha. I said, no, I don't want to come, man. Please go ahead, right? And now here, then I basically thought that, you know, why people don't understand, you know, because in this world, you know, people always are so much self-centric sometimes. And then I had to back off. I said, you know, for next 15 days, I'm not going out of house. So now in, you know, how would you suggest on this situation? Because I thought I took right call. Sorry, I'm taking too much time now.
What is your specific question?
So my question is, should somebody should back off in this kind of scenario, or he should keep continue going? Because you know what, there is a God in him also, right?
Mm-hmm.
He needs help because he has no help outside right now except his wife, and he needs to walk around to get back on his life. And because of this whatever virus, you know, everybody's, you know, we all have now limitations, you know, what should you do and what should you not do. Now, I opted not to help him. And then my question is, you know, if I want to see God in everyone, where is my God?
You see, there's another way to look at this. If you allow me, 2 minutes. One is, first of all, even when we help others, it is a self-centered activity, because we are helping others because it makes us feel good. I feel good that I'm helping someone else in need. So even that is a selfish motive. Okay? That is how the me operates. It has to be seen objectively. Now the other issue is of guilt, that I am feeling guilty because I now want to stop helping a person whom I was helping. Guilt comes in only when there is a sense of doership. I did something. When I do something, there's pride because I did it. Now I'm not doing it, so I feel guilty. Guilt and sin and shame is based on me thinking that there is something that I have done. That is the way the ego works. Now, if one accepts that everyone is an instrument of the divine, of God, the understanding comes that it was my destiny to help this person. And of course, pleasure arose. I felt good because I helped it. But I know now that it was not my doing, because it was the force of consciousness through me which provided help to this friend of mine. Now I understand that I have to be pragmatic, I have to be practical, and given the current scenario, I have to take a decision. Now that also is a part of the functioning of totality. It is not I have to take a decision as an individual who thinks he is doing something. So the realization is that my friend's destiny was to be receiving help from me till a certain point. Now the situation has been reviewed and it's no longer prudent of me to extend that help. That is his destiny and that is my destiny. So when the doership is pulled out from the equation, there's no question of any guilt or shame for now not offering that help. That is when one is living the understanding, whether it is Ramana Maharshi, whether it is Nisargadatta Maharaj or Ramesh Balsekar or the Bhagavad Gita. The ego deluded thinks I am the doer. When that is understood, then you know that your friend was destined to receive help from you for a particular duration of time, and now the destiny has changed. So do review the situation and see the degree of doership which was invested in that, because that will reveal to you. Now, deep down, you may know that it just does not make sense to do this anymore. And there's a total acceptance of that decision. Or it could be the opposite, that you say, to hell with all what is happening. I don't care. I am so deeply in love with my friend that I want to do all that I can for him. And then the decision is taken, knowing that you could not be any other way. But this burden we carry of all these labels of condemnation, blame, guilt, and shame for something I did or something I did not do, that load is dropped. That is why Ramana Maharshi has said that we are like the gopurams in the temples, which are carved into the temple, holding up its pillars. And those gopurams think they are actually holding up the pillars. We are not. We are just instruments in the play of consciousness. And if you are one who is of a pragmatic sense, you will conclude that, no, I did my best. And beyond that, it simply doesn't make sense. And may God take care of him through whichever other means present themselves.
Yes. Yeah. So thank you very much. Yeah. In the beginning, I was helping because... anyways, you know, I believe in nothingness. Anyways, you know, everything is zero. There is nothing, you know, you don't do anything. You don't. Sorry. Sorry, did I mute anyone?
Is there anything else you'd like to ask?
No, that's all, Gautam. That's all. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Hi, Gautam. Am I audible? My name is Amit.
Hello.
Gautam, I would like to ask a question that... in life, you know, if someone has this realization that what we have to go through, that we have to go through it, and nobody can, you know, save us in that particular situation, and a lot of things, you know, beyond our imagination, beyond our, you know, control as well. And of course, it should be that, you know, it's a human tendency that we want to, you know, somewhere, you know, control things. My question is, if I or someone come to the point of realization that what I have to go through, I have to go through it. So what is the best way of surrender yourself? If I want to surrender myself to my guru or consciousness or the God or this nature, so what's the best way to surrender yourself?
The best way is to accept that everything is God's will. It is as simple as that. Because if everything is God's will, it means it is not my will as a separate entity. I am no longer opposed to God's will. And if everything is God's will, and it is certainly not my will, as my life's experiences have shown me, that I can do what I want to do, but the results are not in my control. If one accepts that, that my scope is so limited, as Dayanand Saraswati said, if you take a goat, take a rope and tie it to a peg, put the peg in the ground, the goat can only roam to the extent of the length of the rope. Beyond that, it cannot go. So the free will of the goat is limited to the length of the rope. In that length, It can graze around. That's all it can do. Now the question is, does the goat have free will? And the answer is obvious. It has so-called free will only to the length of the rope. What it decides to do within that area, it's up to it. So when you accept that life has given you a set of circumstances, a whole basket of conditioning since you were born, a genetic blueprint that was not in your control, your breath not in your control, your heart pumping not in your control, the fact that thanks to gravity you're sitting down on a chair, not flying off into the universe, not in your control. When you accept that there is very little in your control, that is surrender. So then nothing has to be done to surrender. Just accepting that is surrender. Then one is living a life of surrender. And when one lives a life of surrender, one is not trying to force one's way and force one's will on events and on people. Because you accept that my whole foundation is one I have absolutely no control over. I don't know if I'll be dead tomorrow. That is the limit to the control I have. So when you give up this excessive need for control, that is the surrender. Nothing needs to be done to surrender. Surrender is to accept that whatever happens is the will of God.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks a lot.
In fact, Amrit, I would say that to try to surrender involves doership and it takes one further away from the surrender. So forget trying to surrender.
So it means that simply be?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much, Gautam. Thanks a lot.
Namaste, Gautamji.
Hi, Gautam.
Namaste.
Is Indira speaking?
Yes, Indira.
I have a lot of questions, but I think I'll just ask you one. Is self-realization something which can be interpreted by the mind?
Self-realization would, it depends on what you define as self-realization. But self-realization in very simple terms is the absence of the individual who thinks he is the doer. Now,
so the reason, yeah,
that means the absence of the thinking mind of the ego who thinks it is the doer. Now, when that is absent, there is no individual who can say I am self-realized. So in that sense, it cannot be interpreted by the mind because that is the absence of the thinking mind. So if someone says I am self-realized, it's actually a paradox because that person who stands up and says, I am self-realized is actually annihilated. And that is what self-realization is. So in that sense, it cannot be interpreted by the mind.
So the reason I'm asking this is, I did have an experience during one of the meditation programs that witnessed what we talk about always. I think I just felt that, I mean, for a second or two, that I'm so big, I'm so bigger than myself, probably a little higher than where I am right now. And then I'm looking at myself down and it's like two beings, you know, there are two people inside me. One is actually in the body and the other one is looking from top. And it was very, very expansive. Like, you know, I didn't feel limited. I was spread all over and it was very, very good. It was very energetic and I didn't know what was happening to me. So I think I was just screaming around that time, but it lasted for very less time, probably a minute, but it was beautiful. And I think that is what the witness is, what I became then. But after 2 minutes, it's gone. I mean, it's gone. Yes. And now I don't get to experience that.
Now in India, I don't want to experience back.
The experience was good, but I'm not craving for it. I know it is, it's a trap of suffering again if I want that experience.
Yes, but at the same time, you've received a beautiful gift, because you have now seen, based on this experience, that you are not limited to the body you thought was Indira.
Yes.
This understanding can take you very far. What happens is that when one has certain experiences, then the me steps in and says, this is my experience. And then it wants to repeat that experience because it felt so good. But the joke is that experience was actually the absence of that small me, as you yourself said. You are much vaster.
Yes.
So what felt good was your own absence. You see? Now, this kind of experience can actually change the way you start viewing your life and the events which happen in your life, because you will see that they are no longer centered around the small me which is sitting inside this body, because there's something vaster than that. So these are pointers on the spiritual journey. They have to be looked at objectively, and they can take one very far on the spiritual journey. And they have to be viewed that way, as long as they don't become the focal point that now I must sit in meditation or I must do that program so that I can repeat the experience, because there is no guarantee that the experience will repeat. And after all, when you had the first experience, you never knew you were going to have it. So it was not in your control.
Right. Yeah, I did see a lot of difference in my life. The suffering really doesn't touch me now. It's like I quit my job just, you know, without really worrying about what is going to happen to me. And I'm just living in peace. Like, you know, I don't want to do anything. I don't want to work. I don't want to do anything. I'm just so peaceful, reading a book or just being myself. And this is a kind of threat to the people around me in my family. So
you have to be careful, because in one of my talks I mentioned a boy who used to come, young boy, and he was very lax about his job. He was in a corporate job and he would show up late, you know. He would not show up on time and his boss was quite frustrated. And so one day he was late and the boss told him that, why are you late again and again? And he told the boss that, I wasn't late, Brahman was late. And it's not a joke, this is a true story. And so he came to me and he said that, this is what happened, and what do I tell my parents? I said, whatever you do, you don't tell your dad that Brahman was fired. So you have to be practical, you have to be understanding. You are living in a world which functions according to certain norms. You have to see your own financial needs, and you know, practical and prudent steps have to be taken along the way. And more importantly, one should not harm others or oneself by certain decisions that are being taken. So this you would know best, that, you know, are you okay not having a job? Are you okay with others not going to, you know, put you in difficult situations, and then flow with it the way you feel it should flow.
Yeah, doesn't mean that I don't want to work, but I don't want to get into the old ways of life, like the old kind of thing, what I'm doing. I want something meaningful to be done now, but I don't see a way out. Like, you know, I'm not really very ambitious, but I just want to do something to help the people around me or the society or anything with respect to the spiritual realm. But not get back and work for myself like I used to do earlier, and, you know, that way.
Trust the universe, it'll unfold.
And I'm very glad to be talking to you. I've been following you from a long time. And Ramesh ji also, thank you so much.
Thank you.